Last night? Did anybody sleep last night? Yeah, there's a few of you. I can't help thinking at a weekend like this, especially after Saturday when you start to get comfortable with everybody again, after not seeing some people for months and years in some cases, that as our brother Frank was talking about yesterday, that this is a work wrought by our God, bringing us all here together from around the world to worship Him, and it's certainly a blessing for us to do that. So we're going to kick off Saturday, Lador 2008. Did I say Saturday? Yeah. Okay, we're starting again Saturday. You have three more classes, right? Did everybody sleep last night? Yes, I did quite well, thank you. We're going to begin with singing together the words of hymn 20, after which we're going to open with a word of prayer from Brother Jason Millard. Hymn 20. For evildoers, fret thou not thyself unquietly, nor do thou envy bear to those that work iniquity. Hymn 20.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, in earth as it is in heaven. We ask that may you please guard, guide us, and help Brother Frank to fill our hearts with the joy, knowledge, and wisdom that we may gather from thy word. We ask that may you please help us to retain everything and pass it on to others and bring others from outside the truth into truth. We ask that may you please help those of us who were not able to make it to this weekend and bring them back to other weekends such as this. We ask all this in and through thy Son's name, our high priest and mediator, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Before our first class this morning, Brother Frank has asked that we read together from Nehemiah chapter 6. We're going to read that with Brother Kevin Mayock.
Reading from the book of Nehemiah, chapter 6. Now it came to pass, when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, Come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono. But they thought to do me mischief. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. What should the work cease whilst I leave and come down to you? Yet they sent unto me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, It is reported among the heathen, and Gashmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king, according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, There is a king in Judah, and now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. Then I sent unto him, saying, There are no such things done as thou sayest, but thou feignest them out of thine own heart. For they all made us afraid, saying, Their hand shall be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Afterward I came unto the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehitabel, who was shut up. And he said, Let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let us shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the night will they come to slay thee. And I said, Should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me. For Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Therefore was he hired that I should be afraid and do so and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works, and on the prophetess Neadiah, and the rest of us, the prophets, that would have put me in fear. So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month, Elul, in 52 days. And it came to pass that when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, they were much cast down in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. Moreover, in those days the nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Era, and his son Johanan had taken the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. Also, they reported his good deeds before me and uttered my words to him. And Tobiah sent letters to me to put me in fear.
Our first class this morning from Brother Frank on the topic of Nehemiah Lessons in Leadership is entitled Achievement in a Hostile Environment. Brother Frank.
Well, first of all, this morning, young people, I'd like to thank everybody who contributed to building the wall. It was a marvelous job done in a very short time by a lot of willing people. It looks pretty smart, I think, in terms of the model and what it's supposed to convey. And that little sense of working together, even if it's a very little thing, just of sometimes how difficult it might be. And as it was pointed out to me, there's a couple little sections of the wall there where you can see that people didn't quite get their act together because the wall didn't join, because they didn't build at the same time. But it just illustrates the wonderful aspects of what you can learn working together. The hall in Shelburne was built by brothers and sisters. We had the opportunity to actually build our own hall, and so we had a couple brethren who were builders who knew how to do it. And the rest of us were all the servants, the volunteers. And if you look carefully through the hall, you will see it was built by people like that. It wasn't built by professional contractors. You're walking along the basement floor, and all of a sudden there's a bump in the floor. And no one would know why there was a bump on the floor except the people that made it. When we put the floor in in the basement of this building, we didn't think about what was going to happen. It was a cold morning. We were putting in concrete. The concrete had a heat liberator in it to try to keep it so it would cure in cold weather. And we went to one, probably a building that was about maybe a little longer than this. We had a hole in the side. They put the concrete through the side. We got wheelbarrows. We wheeled it to various parts on the floor and dumped it. Well, I tell you, within 5 minutes, it was so foggy in there, you couldn't see anybody. So you just hear them working in various places, but you couldn't see anybody else. So everybody was working in their corner on trying to get this floor in. And to get it in level, you have little pegs. You put a peg in, and that's to give you your level. Well, in a couple of cases, they went over the peg. You see the peg, and you know why that little bump there. There's a peg under there. So the person that was working on it was supposed to get that out. But, you know, well, we just cover it up. And all kinds of little things like that, which give it a character, but only to those people who are working on it. Who knew it, and that's you know, a little sense of humor. We often talk about that. Someone comes along and trips on the floor, and it's supposed to be a level floor. No, it isn't quite level there. Another thing they don't know is we have a beam running down through our hall. It looks quite normal, but that's a beam that came out of a railway bridge on a place just north of Toronto, because there's a brother there who saw they were wrecking this bridge. This thing's got a web on it about that high. You know, it's twice as, well, three or four times bigger than it needs to be, but it was free. And these brethren engineered how to put that thing in without a crane by just putting timbers in and rolling it in on timbers, and all the brethren are there at their part getting this huge thing. I mean, if anyone was thinking about safety, they forgot it at that moment. They got this thing on the piers, and we built the floor into it instead of on top of it. You know, no one would ever know that, because the way it's covered up, it's just gone. Except the people who worked on it, and they know that. And I think that's the nice thing about the wall. I'm sure the people who worked on that, goldsmiths, chuckled for many years afterwards about what they knew about the wall that others didn't. And one of the things this morning I wanted to tell you about is something you probably don't know about that wall. Now, in keeping with what we're saying last night, that, you know, there's things happen in today's world. You just want to make a little list of these things. I'll give you a website where you can get this information. It's www.bibleinthenews.com. And some of you might already know this. It's a website where Bible Magazine prints news items. So it's www.bibleinthenews, all one word, bibleinthenews.com. And it's interesting because here we are working on Nehemiah's temple walls, and right in this place, I think I can actually do this without getting into trouble here, right in there. Now, that's where the Nethinims were. Hey, they were the priests that worked on the temple. They had their place there. And it does mention it in Nehemiah. If you have a look at this, it's in Nehemiah chapter 7. Nehemiah chapter 7. And if you're looking at verse 55, it says, "And the children of Barcos, and the children of Sisera, the children of Tama, the children of Neziah, the children of Hattaphiah, etc." And all these people were people that were servants, the Nethinims, verse 46. So they were the people that were appointed to help in the service of the temple. So they're right next to the temple, and that's where their housing was. Well, if you think of where that is today, that would be on the south wall of the Temple Mount, very disputed place, a very delicate place between the Jews and the Arabs, because they've noticed that the wall's bulging out there, and the Jewish people want to repair it. But you see, on top of that is one of the mosques, one of these sacred mosques. So the Arabs don't want them, or the Muslims don't want them digging there or doing anything, but the Israelis want to do it because they see the wall bulging. And anyway, they're being digging there, and they find this seal. Now, you know what I mean by a seal? You know, if it was a family seal, well, guess where it came from? Nehemiah chapter 7, verse 55, the family of the children of Tama. Now, this whole article, and it made the news. I'm sure that a lot of you would have heard of it because it was reported in various news articles around the world. But there was this little seal here. It was found, or it was reported, in January 18, 2008, very recent. But the Jewish people just, you know, thought this was wonderful because this illustrated that the history of that place went back 2,500 years to Nehemiah's time, whereas the Arabs would sort of be disputing there was never a temple there. And the critical thing is that the Israeli government, in order to get peace, wants to sort of maybe divide that part and let the Arabs have their part of Jerusalem. And because of the politics of this seal found from, you know, that family of the children of Tama, some of the political parties that were supporting the Israeli government pulled out of the government. So I thought, that's really fascinating. Here we are studying Nehemiah, and that little seal is being buried there for, what, 2,500 years. And they find it a couple weeks before we're meeting here to talk on Nehemiah. Now, I really take a lot of note of that. Like other people might, well, you know, it's just circumstances. But, you know, that was buried for 2,500 years. And it's just a further sequence of things to illustrate for people who are watching, who are reading their Bibles and watching, that God is active and he's working and he's not going to let that city just go any direction. That's his city. That's the only city of the world that God has ever said was his. That's where he will dwell. And that's where the focus of the age to come will be, in that city of Jerusalem. You go there and you walk around the place and you have to think of it in terms of what the Bible says. It's going to be an earthquake. It's going to change that city so much. Don't expect to see those walls. Like, you can look down on the city of Jerusalem from the hills around it, but the Bible gives you the idea that it's going to be exalted above the hills. So with an earthquake coming through the Mount of Olives to that place, I can't imagine too much of that's going to be left. And Jesus did say there wouldn't be one stone left upon another. Some might dispute that that's already happened, but when they dig down under that western wall, they have found some of the massive stones that were there, must have been in Solomon's time, that were put there to develop those walls. So I would think there's got to be a lot happen there, but God just allows us to have information illustrating that this is current, this is up to date. Now, I want to look in Nehemiah chapter 2 to start this talk off, because we want to elaborate on what we found in Nehemiah 6. That's quite a chapter of reading about the adversaries and how did he ever manage to continue to so support and move on this effort when he had those kinds of enemies. Well, there's an extremely important lesson comes out of this. Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Now, we've read this before, but let's just go through it again. This is Nehemiah. After all his study, all his buildup, the hand of God working favorably in his life, he comes down to the people. He's been there 3 days. He has a look at this, and then he meets with these people. Now, this is his commitment to them. I said unto them, you see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come, let us build up the wall of Jerusalem that we be no more a reproach. Then I told them of the hand of my God which was good upon me, and also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. Now, what do you think about that statement? If you've done any air travel, or you've even thought about air travel, you will know that when an airplane's taking off, you get to a point on the runway where you have to take off because you don't have enough runway left to stop. Now, if you think about that, there's a lot of situations in life like that. Like you're so committed, you can't stop. You've got to carry through. Here's Nehemiah committing himself after all this preparation, all his desires. It was in his own head for a long time, and he didn't have to worry about commitment in a sense because he never told anybody else. But after this couple of verses in the record, he's now committed because he told everybody what he was going to do. And I think it wasn't just that what he was going to do, but he said, the hand of my God, which was good upon me. Now, young people, and I'm directing these words to you as young people, not as just, you know, brothers and sisters in Christ and younger people, but one of the things you really have to watch in life is that you never forget that. There's a point in which there is no return. You can't come back. You've done this. You're committed to it. And I think that's when you say you have faith. When you say you have faith, and you've started on the course of discipleship, or you've started into something where you feel in your mind God is behind you, how can you back up? But you'd have to deny that God ever was behind you. Like, you have to say, well, I was wrong. And that's commitment, and the commitment has to be felt. So if you think of faith as a stairway, it's probably the best way to think of it. At least it's been very helpful to me to think of faith as a stairway. You don't even get on the first step until you've, in some sense in your own mind, said, well, I do think I have faith. And I really do think that, you know, God was working with me in that event. And I do think that when I was baptized that the angels did rejoice and God was happy with it. Like, that's the first level you usually get to. Well, then why wouldn't you think that God would be with you in the next step? Like, why wouldn't the logic of that idea in your mind drive you to step two? So you're facing another set of obstacles in life, and, well, if God was with me in the first step, surely he can get me through the second step. And then, you know, it's not long after, there's a third step. But there's steps. And as you get higher in the steps of faith, your faith gets stronger. But what happens sometimes is people second guess themselves. You know, I'm not too sure maybe God was with me. You ever played the game Snakes and Ladders? A snake, you can go down real fast, right back to where you started. And I often think of that little game we used to play together, had a lot of fun with Snakes and Ladders. That's like faith and the denial of faith. You got to climb a ladder. You got to work at that faith to get higher and higher so that your faith is growing. But in our mind is a very deceitful thing to work with. And every now and then it says, oh, no, God wasn't with you. That was just chance factors that came together at that time, and here you are. Or you know that you weren't really convinced. It was more or less the persuasion of peers, and, you know, it's what your parents wanted. And you remember you were baptized because, well, you thought it would be a great thing. All the people were going to be there that weekend, so you were baptized that weekend. There are all kinds of reasons that doubt comes into our mind to say, well, you weren't really sincere. And the flesh is like that. That's the way the flesh is. So we've got to be prepared to deal with that. And that's, you see, Nehemiah, like he gave his commitment, but when all this controversy, all these adversaries come, he would have second-guessed that. And how did he manage to have himself strong enough not to give in? When you're facing some of the things we just read about in chapter 6, which is only one of the chapters that deals with it, illustrates you, there has to be a toughness of mind for a person to carry through on their commitment. And I tend to think that if you keep your commitment in your mind, that is a real help. You know, I learn these things. I just try to keep track of everything anyone ever tells me that I think is really good. Therefore, you know, when people talk or when I talk, I'm not really talking about a lot of the ideas that I came up with. Many of them aren't. They're just ideas that I thought, hey, that's a good idea. So I wrote it down in my mind. I couldn't even tell you where some of these ideas came from. But my daughter told me about something, and I'll never forget about it. And I thought, yeah, that was a really good idea. I don't know why we didn't do it when we were first married. You know, if any of you are married, can you remember what you said as your vows? Like some people memorize them. It sounds so beautiful to see, you know, a man and a young man, a young woman looking at each other in the eye and saying this from memory under those conditions. That's hard. I mean, that's, you got talent, boy, and you got ways to go in life if you can do that. But we forget them. And when the trouble comes like it is in Nehemiah chapter 6 in a married life, well, boy, you know, do you remember those vows? So what she did was, and she and Chris, they decided that what they would do is they'd take their vows, they would write them on a big picture of them when they were married. So, I mean, you'd usually have lots of pictures, and they write their vows down, put it right over their bed. Every night, they come in and they see that picture and they see those vows. Now, that to my mind is good sense, good practical sense. It's like a man going today, some of you young men out there working in an environment where you never intended, it wasn't your idea that you would have to actually work on a project with a young woman, an attractive young woman. And you're already married. You don't want another attractive woman in your life, but there she is. Wouldn't it be a good idea just to put a picture of your wife on your desk? See, the flesh doesn't want you to do that. The flesh is always saying, flirt, see how close you can get to the barrier. You know you won't fall off. That's deceit of the mind. The practical idea that would be good is, hey, I made a commitment here. And I made a vow before my God, I'm not going to allow myself to forget. I'm going to put a picture of my wife right on my desk. Like, that's just telling everybody else, stay away. I'm quite happy, and she's the woman of my life. Now, young men, think of that. Because I can tell you stories of where it just fragmented because a young man didn't put those defenses in place. And I would think, you know, other people can think of young women that had the same experience. So there has to be a sort of a set of smarts that you have to do, practical things, in order to get through these times of controversy and difficulty that are coming ahead. And when you see this in the book of Nehemiah, my hand of my God was good upon me. Don't ever go back on that. If you believe God was with you and you rejoiced and you gave him thanks for it, then just make sure you remember it somehow. And that will help you, give you a lot of strength later on. Now, this is what psychologists tell us. And few people in psychology around here know a lot more about it than me. But they tell you that in difficulty, you do one of two things. You either fight or you flee. Now, what are you? Because we divide on this, and we generally know by this time of life what kind of a person we are. When you get into difficulty, you just want to run? Are you the person that just gets out of the way? Just like, just leave me out of it. I don't want any part of this. Or are you the kind of a person that will sit there and fight it out, slug it out with whatever the adversary is? Now, we can get ourselves into big trouble both ways, as you can well imagine. But I want you to look at a few of these things, because I think what happens very often is when Nehemiah was faced with these adversaries that were from within, that's a much more difficult adversary. I can deal with the issues at work, because I... try to just, over the years, build it such that when I leave work, I leave work. Don't take it home. I tried this. I was in teaching, got in teaching, was in there for 13 years, and got a bit bored with teaching, you know, going in the same classroom, teaching, you know, the same stuff all those years. So I thought, oh, I'm going to get out of this. I went into my own business. I left teaching, and I started, you know, advertising, and I did survey work, going to companies and doing surveys based on what the employees had to say, and then trying to figure out a strategy of how to deal with it. And it worked fairly good, but it was a feast or famine, as a lot of you people would know what that means. Like, if you're always worried about getting too big, because if you advertise broadly and you say, oh yeah, I'll take that client on, well, the clients I took on, was any one of those clients was enough work for a year for me. But I was constantly being told, you've got to get bigger. And I didn't like employing people, so I refused to do that. I eventually got out of it and went back to work for somebody else. Found it much easier to work for another boss than myself. Because I couldn't come home and leave it behind. When I got home, I worked out of home. So it was always there. And in terms of the truth, it just got in the way. So it was better for me just to get out of that. So you could come home and you could leave it away. You leave it there where it was. And I think that's one of the aspects that we have to face in our modern life, because a lot of people now are actually able to work from home because of the internet. You got high-speed internet. You can talk to people all around the world from your own home. You don't need to have an office. And the company says, hey, that's a good idea because we don't have to provide you an office. So it's cheaper for us, cheaper for you. Everybody's happy. Well, you may not be happy in the truth, unless it's a job that you can leave in a room and live out somewhere else in your house. Because if you got it with you all the time, I never found a way to really relax, because you're always thinking of what you should do. It's like farming. As long as you're out on the farm, there's always something to do. You know, there's a board blowing off the barn, waving there. You know that board's going to come down, but it's higher than your ladder is. So you got to risk your life a little bit to get up on the top rung of a ladder, which is already, you know, about 20, 25 feet high. And here you are. I don't know if you've ever done that, but you got to hold this board up and nail it. A lot of things about life like that, you think about this about 3 weeks before you even try it. I'm not too sure I got the courage to go up there while the wind's too high today. And then finally, the board blows off. Then not only have you got to put the board back on, but you got to carry it up the ladder to put it on and hold it up there in place. Well, these jobs, I find, I'd just rather leave it, work for somebody else, come home, and then put my time into what the scriptures really want us to do, is to study God's word and to be able to handle it on that basis. Now, here's a verse that I found very helpful in trying to get you through these difficulties, because we don't have time to get into this study little, you know, piecemeal, but we do have time to draw your attention to the richness of this study, which means that, you know, the real value would be when you get into it yourself. But how do you deal with an ecclesia where it's not peace? You know, if you come up with an idea, you can almost be sure, you can actually put names on a paper. These will be the people that will be against this idea. And so it stifles any kind of work that you might want to do. And that is unfortunate, because I don't know that people really want that to happen. It just happens because we just default to it. But the pastoral epistles have been very helpful. And for any of you young men wrestling with these issues in your ecclesia, like you just don't feel there's any place for you there, like older brethren won't move aside a bit. They don't develop the youth. They sort of feel like they're going to be there doing these jobs till they die. That's a long time to wait when you're a young man. But if you have a look at 2 Timothy chapter 2, this was Paul's advice to a young man. And this was Paul's advice to a young man who was given a very, very difficult job to do, and that was to get things right in Ephesus, a big ecclesia, a lot of people coming and going. And it must have been an extremely difficult thing for this young man, who wouldn't have seemed to have been a real strong character physically, from what it says. But nevertheless, the work needed to be done. So Paul tells him in verse 20 of 2 Timothy 2, in a great house there are not only vessels of gold and silver, but also of wood and earth, some to honor and some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified, meet for the master's use, and prepared unto every good work. Now, first of all, what that doesn't mean. The idea of purging oneself from these might mean, for people who naturally flee, there's my license to get out. When things in the ecclesia turn rough and it doesn't look like you can do anything, just leave and find some other ecclesia. And even though, you know, that you say, well, that's not really the intent of verse 21, it's probably led to new ecclesias developing. And so, looking at the broad picture over a number of years, you can say, well, the truth spread for these reasons. Now, Aunt Dorothy and I did a study on the history of the truth in America many, many years ago. And we were really, I guess, impressed and unimpressed at the same time. There was an ecclesia in Halifax. You know where Halifax is? In Canada, on the East Coast, Nova Scotia. Halifax was a port city for people coming from England. So a lot of people coming from England stopped in Halifax, and then they proceeded to various parts around the continent. But Robert Roberts makes a comment on this when he was visiting Halifax. This is going back to his day, so a long time ago. There was an ecclesia of about 100 members there. There isn't any ecclesia there. Like, there's an ecclesia in Bedford and some other places around Halifax, but really there's no continuity. The ecclesia died, 100 members in Robert Roberts' time. And he makes a little note. You pick this out of the pages of the Christadelphians, the correspondence there, that the ecclesia was noted for controversy. Like, the people were arguing, and they just couldn't get along. And you say, well, there you are, no ecclesia in Halifax. But what it did was it sent people to the West Coast. They were able to go all over America to get away from that kind of controversy, and hence there were other ecclesias started up, and the truth spread through that. So it's two edges to this, but I'm trying to concentrate on the first one, and that is that you don't want to flee because of controversy when you know that in a great house there are vessels of gold and silver, and there's some of wood and stone. There are some that won't ever stand the test of fire and judgment, and there's some that will, but you're in the ecclesia together, and he doesn't tell us, doesn't give us the admonition to leave, or else Timothy couldn't have ever done the work he did in Ephesus. So although you might be frustrated, and although your frustration may be, you know, genuine or it may not be, it's not a reason to think I got to get out of here, because you will never develop the kind of character that you need if you always take that idea. Don't like it, I'm leaving. Don't like it, I'm leaving. How do you think those little rocks in the bottom of a riverbed get polished, get shaped round? Like, rocks don't come out there round. I guess there's some of the volcanic rocks might come out round, but most of the ones in the river are round because they're rubbing another. They get the edges chipped off them. Now, I'm sure every one of us know we have a few edges that need to be chipped off. It's just hard to let them go. Well, we need each other for that. Like, it was God's idea to put us together in ecclesias. It wasn't our idea. We'd probably all have our own little ecclesia based on our family. Everyone thought exactly the same. Where God saw, no, that's not the way to achieve character. You've got to be in these circumstances like Nehemiah was, with people who are against you, to really set the record right so that others can develop on it. So we look at Nehemiah, and we're not really trying to be historians through this. That's not our purpose. Our purpose is to see what we can learn from his life so that we can be better in our own life. And hence, that's the lessons that we're following. If you wanted another one on this, I've always found this very helpful. It's in Revelation chapter 2. And it's talking about the ecclesia at Thyatira. Now, some of the things it mentions in Thyatira, you'd say, well, if you got a woman like Jezebel in the city, in this ecclesia, why not move to the one just down the road? Well, there isn't any of that. There's never advice to move to another ecclesia in Revelation. You will never find justification for that there. Although, when ecclesias are very close together, that's a possibility. And we find in Shelburne, I don't even want to investigate the reasons why this may be true, but we have people that live across the road from the ecclesia go to a different ecclesia. Those kinds of things really puzzle you at times. But nevertheless, what he says here is in verse 24, I say unto you and to the rest in Thyatira, as many as have not this doctrine and which have not known the depths of Satan as they speak, I will put upon you none other burden but that which you have already, hold fast till I come. Now you got to remember that. Nehemiah must have had to remember that from something or have come to that understanding that you don't abandon ship because everyone doesn't agree with you and you're getting all this kind of bad advice and all these problems. You got to remember what you said. God was with me to bring me to this point. Hence, to go to the next step, I'm not going to deny that. I'm going to work on that to get to the next step. If God brought me this far, then he can bring me the next stairway or the next step in life. If I had to wait until I could see the circumstances were right and the king would be favorable to me, then maybe it's just a matter of waiting until the right time and we can move to the next step. I think that's very, very critical in our life. Now this man, Eliashib, we meet him in Nehemiah chapter 13 in the probably the critical part of his influence at the time of Nehemiah. And I am wrestled with this, and I'm sure anyone who has read the book, coming to chapter 13, is really puzzled over how this could ever happen. But this man is the man who is the high priest. So he, in terms of the spiritual leadership of the city or of the nation, he's number one man. And it says of him in verse 4 of Nehemiah 13, before this, Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of our God, was allied unto Tobiah. And he had prepared for him a great chamber, where aforetime they laid the meat offerings, the frankincense, the vessels, the tithes of corn, the new wine, and the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites, and the singers, and the porters, and the offerings of the priests. But in all this time I was not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king. And after certain days obtained I leave of the king, and I came to Jerusalem and understood the evil that Eliashib did for Tobiah, and preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me sore. Therefore I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. I mean, you can just sort of imagining that happen. That he was very upset with this and just, you know, I don't know, it was a fit of anger or whatever it was, but it would have been something to watch to see him doing that. But what had Eliashib done? Like, Eliashib was one of the builders on the wall. Like, he was out there working, so you couldn't fault him for that. And it would have been a good example. In fact, I think, really, that he was the first one. So he gave that leadership. But then he caved in on this aspect of it. So where was the weakness? Well, how was it that he became allied with Tobiah? That's the key thing. Verse 4, and was allied unto Tobiah. Well, it was with a marriage alliance. His son, his daughter, you know, those kinds of things where people who may at one time have been very strong on an issue, all of a sudden because of a marriage problem, are no longer that sort of conservative bastion they were at one time. And now they've changed their mind in these issues and become much more liberal. But it seems that Eliashib couldn't handle it at all. In other words, he'd married into a family where Tobiah, much stronger person, much stronger personality, knew what he wanted, was going to achieve it one way or another. So he talked Eliashib into getting rid of the very means of sustaining the spiritual high in Israel. That was to provide for the Levites so they could do their job. If there was no food for them, they had to get back to their land and start working the land so they had enough food to survive, and they couldn't put their time on spiritual things. So it stifled the spiritual development. In just the few years that Nehemiah was away, this happened. You can understand how difficult it was for him to handle it. Now, the seeds of this are back in another chapter. If you go back to Nehemiah chapter 10... you would expect to see that the people who sealed to the covenant, in other words, they attested that the covenant that Nehemiah set up of what they would do, pledging themselves to carry it out,
One of the names you would find on the very top would be this man, Eliashib. But you find it was Nehemiah, the Tirshatha, and that is the Nehemiah that we're talking about here. But you don't find Eliashib there. Why wouldn't this priest do this? Like he provided leadership in being one of the first people to work on the wall, but he wouldn't seal to the covenant. Now, that's interesting because if you go way back to Deuteronomy chapter 27, you can see how God viewed this. In other words, a person might say, well, look, I'm just not going to commit myself to doing the will of God, and therefore I'm out of it. I don't really have any obligations. Well, if you remember this incident, like we don't have time to deal with it all, but it is a very interesting thing. When Joshua went into the land, he was told that he was to make a copy of the law by plastering, writing it in plaster. And then there would be part of the nation would give the curses in Mount Ebal, and then part of them would give the blessings on Mount Gerizim. And they went through all of these blessings and cursings, as you can see in verse 15, cursed be the man. Verse 16, cursed be the man. And all these cursings. But look at the last one. Cursed be he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them. Now that's another level of cursing. Rather than, like, if you do this, if you break this law, you're cursed. It's the person who said, well, I won't make that oath. I won't take part of this. Therefore, I'm out of it. Like, I'm not obliged to keep it. Well, what would you do with that? Cursed is he that confirmeth not all the words of this law to do them. Like, you're cursed if you don't give your name. If you don't take part of this, you're cursed. And here's the man, the high priest. You don't see his name on the list. It may have been, like, we don't know for the exact reasons, but it may have been that Eliashib thought he could get out of that. Like, he knew that this alliance was developing. And, you know, a number of you young people wouldn't have the feeling of this, but, you know, Dorothy and I have been through this. You know what it's like to have your children marry and how you're concerned about who they marry and you're concerned about, you know, what happens afterwards. And it's a big concern because, I mean, you've raised these children. You've brought them up the best you can in a godly environment. And then to see them wander away or to see someone having such an influence on them that it's overpowering them. Like, this is an aspect of parenting you don't see until you get quite old in life, and then you see something, and I'm sure there's a lot of parents have bitter, bitter feelings about this. If you could ever go back and do it again, I could spend more time with my children to build a stronger mind. How easily they were just pushed over by falling in love with a person who had some other ideas altogether and just won them over, and away they went. And they left the truth, they left their whole heritage, and they're gone. Well, that can happen. And one of the things that I'm sure we would want to do is make sure that we develop that kind of strength of character and understanding about the scriptures, that they're not an easy take, at least. In fact, it would be better if the children coming up to that age were wise enough to look into things a little bit before they got committed. Like, not just to commit themselves so quickly to somebody else, but think it through. Where is this going? Well, our experience, having a fairly large family, is